This is Photo Geek Weekly, episode 36. I'm your host, Don Komarechka, and this is the podcast where we geek out about photography, digging through the news stories, finding the geekiest topics that we can talk about, or taking a general purpose topic and digging into all the geeky facets of it, just to find some things that maybe other people haven't talked about, or to just get technical, to get understanding. And with me today is actually the guy that I had as the very first guest host on this podcast back in episode 3. He's been back a couple of times since then, and I always value his opinion. Mike Howard, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, and it's an honor to be back on the show. Big fan of Don and everything you do.
Well, thanks. I'm something of like a mad scientist photographer when it comes to my my experiments, and I enjoy that. Photography becomes a creative journey, but it's also a personal one to explore the world around you, and it gives me reason to see things differently, and that makes it a passion.
And you're everywhere. Everywhere I turn around, there's Don. I was talking to some other photographer, and I don't remember the subject, and he said, oh, yeah, Don was at an event that we were doing, and he gave a speech. And I know you're going to ask me which event, and I don't remember which
it was
event.
Probably the NECCC in Amherst, Massachusetts. That's the most recent one I was
at. That might have been it. It was within the last month or so, yes.
Yeah, and that was a ton of fun. I love doing those presentations, especially when they ask me to talk on topics like ultraviolet photography. Mm-hmm. I'm like, sure, there'll be five people in the audience. I don't mind talking to those five very enthusiastic people. But no, that was actually a pretty full room for that presentation.
Well, he
and they had
it.
Me do a few others too. So
he enjoyed it. So.
Yeah, it's been busy for me too. I did some workshops here recently for a couple of weekends, and I did a big art show. That was the August long weekend that we have here in Canada, first weekend in August. And my goodness, it was hot. It was, so hot and humid and sunny and no wind even by the waterfront that everybody walking by was just zombies. I did sell quite a bit. It was a profitable show for me, but it would have been better had there been a brisk bit of, crispness in the air,
Well, fall is coming. Fall is coming.
It is. But that's the only art show that I do a year. Oh. And so sometimes we've had almost tornado-like weather where I'm packing up my tent and I look and I see a tint of green in the clouds and I'm thinking that's not a good thing.
Can't
be good. Have you ever done any art shows or sold your art in a public venue, Mike?
I have not. I've been to art shows, but I've never sold any of mine, no.
It's a challenge because you have to wear two hats at the same time. You have to be both an artist that is gracious and accepting of compliments and explains their work passionately. You have to be a salesman. You have to say, do you have any space on your walls for that? It's like, I see you admiring that. Do you want to know the backstory? And once you tell them, you can say, by the way, if you want to put this on your walls, I'll give you a 5x7 of the behind the scenes photograph for you to use as a conversation piece to anybody that admires it. You gotta sell it, right? Yeah. You have to close the sale. And I've had a lot of years in retail, and so maybe that helps with that regard.
I would be awful. I'm not a good salesman.
Yeah, well, and it's not like I'm trying to push people. It's right. Like, okay, they're admiring it, but you've got to allow them to picture it in their lives
exactly.
After they walk away. Because if they don't walk away with the artwork right then, you're done. They're not coming back.
Right.
I had one lady, and this was kind of disappointing for me. I had this beautiful 30x20 metal print of a dragonfly fluorescing in ultraviolet light. It's one of my favorite UV images. And she walked by on the first day and said, you know what? I'm going to take that. Her husband was agreeing with her right then and there. And she said, we're just going to walk the show. We're going to come back. Do you want me to pay for it now? I should have selfishly said yes. But I was trusting of this woman. And I said, no, you know what? I will write sold on the tag for it. And it will be yours. You're going to come back. And I know for sure that somebody else came by and wanted to buy it and didn't buy it because it said sold on it. And that lady never came back. So lesson learned. There's always lessons to be learned.
Yeah, I guess that happens. It's, once they've walked away, yes, it's hard for them to come back and make the purchase. But I think for me personally, I would have told you, don't put sold on there just in case somebody else comes by.
Yeah, well, I was being nice. Came back to buy it and it said sold on that looks good in their favor that I was looking after them
Absolutely.
And making sure that their purchase
you had
was
to
theirs.
Do that. You had to do that, yep.
Yeah. But anyhow, that art show is utterly exhausting, and there's a reason why I only do one of those a year. we're gearing up for travels in the next little while, so hopefully I can get enough of this work to bed. One of the reasons why I mentioned that at the top of the show is just as a reminder for me to say, anybody listening to this, there will be no Photo Geek Weekly next week or the week after. We're going to be coming back in the first week of September with a vengeance. I'm sure there will be a ton of news, just regular riffraff to talk about, plus rumors from Photokina that are already heating up, which will be our first story. But before we get to that, Mike, how are you? What's new and exciting?
Same old stuff. JPEG to RAW still going great. We're, you know, I think we're on almost month number 100 of our photo contest. It just keeps going on. We do a separate review show and where we review some of the photos in there with AD Wheeler, and that's going great too. So
tell me some of the highlights, recent guests or recent images that wowed you.
So the show's gone through phases, I will tell you. So we went through an early phase, and just, you know, people ask me sometimes, what is JPEG to RAW? What are you converting JPEGs into RAW? How's that possible?
A whole podcast about this. Yes. On a weekly basis.
And that's not what it is. It's supposed to mean the journey of from a beginner being a JPEGger to seasoned photographer being a RAW person. Not saying you have to be one or the other, but just a journey. And we've gone through phases where we didn't have that many guests at early on in the show, and to where we had lots of guests. And now Tim and I are mainly doing news. Like, we're going to talk about some of the stuff tonight, but we mainly do news. And I think we're about to phase back in to start doing guests again. Why we did that is both Tim and our schedules were a little wonky. And I felt uncomfortable scheduling a date with a guest and then having to back out. So we wanted to get through some of that time frame before we get guests back in. But I think we'd like to have a guy named Don come back on and talk about some of that ultraviolet. But I haven't reached out to him to schedule a date until we get past some of these things. So it's on me.
When we're back home in September, we're traveling to Bulgaria and spending a few days in Vienna as well. It's going to be a ton of fun. My wife is originally from Bulgaria, so we go back every year to visit friends and family, nice. Usually add a road trip into the mix. And so there'll be a ton of interesting imagery. I'll actually be bringing a camera capable of shooting ultraviolet reflectance. That's the direct capture of UV light with a lens that can potentially function as a landscape lens. And almost nobody is doing ultraviolet landscape photography. So I'm about to dip my toes into those waters as well. Could be fun. But so, Mike, JPEG to RAW, of which I've been a guest on a number of times in the past, and I've really enjoyed that experience. I'm envious of the fact that you can kind of schedule guests and you could do like two episodes back to back and then you wouldn't have a hiatus like I'm about to have. Mm-hmm. But enough of that. Let's dig into the juicy bits of the news. Yep. Unless you have one more thing to add.
No, I'm just saying sometimes, you know, like you're doing a trip right now. Sometimes you have to skip a little bit. I think that's fine. You know, we're not doing this necessarily for a living. You know,
I'm not making my living from the podcast. Right. I make very little. I make a little bit from people that put a couple of dollars in the tip jar, which there's a link to that on the Photo Geek Weekly mm-hmm. website. And thank you to everybody that does that. I have to start posting stuff to Patreon now that I've got enough, people supporting me there too. But it right now and for the foreseeable future, it won't even cover the hosting and editing costs on it.
And we do it. You probably do it the same way. We do the show for because we love the topic. We love photography. We love to talk about photography. And that's why we do it. So from time to time, there may be some times where we miss a show.
Yeah, exactly. But hey, forgive me. Yeah. this episode should make up for the gap. We got a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Number one is reported by Petapixel and widely from other places. The original source, I don't think that they specifically, they say Nikon Rumors, and then it's probably somewhere else from Nikon Rumors and so on and so forth. But Nikon, they're saying the Z6 and Z7 or Z6, Z7. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You're looking at the new mirrorless cameras from Nikon, full frame mirrorless. And there are very, very few specs available to us right now. Suffice to say, there is some photographs. There will be two models. The Z6 will be a 24 megapixel high speed low light camera, and the Z7 will be a 45 megapixel high resolution camera. Mike, does that sound familiar to you at all?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a lot like Sony. I mean, they're getting in the same boat with Sony, and they're going to, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of similarities.
Well, especially since Sony is manufacturing the sensors as well. Mm-hmm. And Nikon, quote unquote, designs the sensors because Nikon has a different patent portfolio than Sony. And sometimes licensing certain patents ends up being cost prohibitive, or they just don't do it for competitive reasons. So the Nikon cameras might have different features from the Sony sensors, and vice versa as well. But it seems like they are treading in the path of Sony. And Sony's three generations, almost four generations into their mirrorless platform, where they had the A7S and A7R originally years ago, it seems like that's what Nikon is rushing out the door with. And granted, the quality will probably be better than Sony's initial offerings because we are further down that technological path. But to start out with a new mount, an entirely new system, when Sony also just announced in a related story that they are the number one camera seller in the mirrorless market, or was it full frame interchangeable lens camera market
in the US? And,
in the U.S., yes. Yep. So they've launched their B Alpha campaign, which maybe this was a long game for them, using Alpha as the name, because now that they are the Alpha, that it makes more sense. And if they had planned that from the beginning, then kudos to them. So this is a very interesting time.
I've said this on our show before, and you see this repeated in history of businesses, and I don't have any inside knowledge, so this is just my guess, so take that for what it's worth. But often when a competitor comes up that's got a new product or a new way of doing something, the old company will sit back and say, but we are Sears or we are Nikon or whatever, and we're not going to do that. We're not going to lose the spot. Or if we make a mirrorless camera, it's going to cannibalize our SLRs, our digital SLRs, and we don't want to do that. But what they fail to realize is if you don't cannibalize your own sales, someone else will do it for you, and that's what's happened with Sony. So they got behind the curve. Sony has blown past them with this, and it's not too late, I don't think. They have lost some users who've moved over, and I think in the camera world, when you lose people over to another brand and they start buying lenses and everything, you don't get them back as easy.
Yeah, some people flip-flop, but really it almost looks bad on the photographer for say, hey, I'm Nikon, and then I jump over to Sony, and then you're back to Nikon. Yeah. Well, why did you switch to begin with?
Exactly.
So it's expensive to switch.
It's expensive.
But not only is it expensive, I mean, it's a hit to your ego, I suppose, in some ways. We're looking at some of the fundamentals of the Nikon F mount as well, that they were not flawed per se from the beginning. But there were some limitations in terms of aperture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I think I might have mentioned it on the podcast in previous episodes, but people don't realize that the Nikon, at least the autofocus modern version of the F-mount, the way that they installed the communication to the lens narrowed the rear objective lens element maximum size. And that meant that f1.4 was the maximum aperture capable of those cameras. You can get a manual focus lens. In fact, Nikon, they've had a number of 50 to 58 millimeter f1.2 lenses. The Nokt Nikkor 58 millimeter f1.2 is sought after very highly by collectors, probably more so than it's worth. Mm-hmm. But it was a big thing for Nikon to have. When both Canon and Nikon were switching to the electronic world, when Canon rolled out their EOS system, they kind of punched Nikon in the gut a little bit by coming out with their 50 millimeter f1.0 lens. And the lens wasn't all that good, and it was ridiculously overpriced, but that didn't matter because on paper, that number means something to people buying into a system. And those lenses are also quite sought after these days too. But the challenge for Nikon was they couldn't make it. It was just technically impossible, even if they wanted to. And so one of their latest teaser videos that they've put out is showcasing that Nokt Nikkor 58 millimeter F1.2. And the rumors from Nikon Rumors say that it's pretty much a slam dunk case that we're going to get a 58mm f0.95 lens from Nikon on the way. Now, that would be pretty groundbreaking because there is no autofocus capable f0.95 lens on the market, to my knowledge. There are a variety of manual focus, purely mechanical lenses that will do this. But if Nikon is able to get autofocus to work at such a wide aperture with this new system right out of the gates or very close to the launch of these products, if they could launch the announcement of it and deliver later, then I think that might be a game changer for them. It might, kick them a couple of spaces ahead in this race because Sony still doesn't have a lens like that. Neither does any of the players. But how hard would it be to just say, yeah, we can make one too. Here's our announcement. It'll be out next year. And then it just takes the wind out of Nikon sales.
Yeah, I don't know what Nikon's game plan is, but for me, I'm a Nikon user. For me, what I see this move doing is, one, you had to, if you're in this business, if you're Canon or Nikon, you have to make a mirrorless. You have to go that route. If you don't want to keep bleeding your users over to Sony, you've got to do that. So hopefully at that point, whether, you know, someone like me, I'm not going to rush out and buy one of these cameras. I'm going to wait. I'm fine with my current camera. And when I get ready to buy my next camera, I'll look at them and decide whether I want them or the current DSLR that's out there. But I'm not going to jump. But I think some users who are convinced they have to have mirrorless and they're Nikon users currently, this may cause them to pause and not move to Sony and maybe buy one of these cameras and stay here.
Yeah, well, and also it becomes a transitional element too. You can be sure that Nikon will have some method in place to allow existing Nikon users to adapt their lenses to this new system. It would be crazy, asinine for them not to do that. So that will be part of this transition. But even if, Sony, when they came out with their A9, they put the Nikon D3, D4, D5, et cetera, people, and the Canon 1D series squarely in their sights. But how many of them jumped over in product version 1? Yeah. Probably a few, but not a whole lot. And I think that that is sort of a long game. That's, Windows rolling out Windows 3.1. There was no Windows 3.0. Mm-hmm. It's just you want to make it feel like it has established itself in its current state to a point where it is more robust, more feature-filled, and fewer kinks to work out. So if you look back at what Sony has done in the past, they probably didn't move a whole lot of their very first generations of certain products. And the A9, I think, is in that boat, but the A9 Mark II. That's gonna pull even more people from the high end, the flagship Canon Nikon cameras. And like we've established, it's hard for them to move back. Mm-hmm. And so if Nikon can't keep those users with a flagship mirrorless product that does everything that their flagship mirrored product does, then, I'm kind of waffling back and forth. I want them to succeed. I want the industry to have the greatest level of competition possible.
Right.
Because us as consumers, as the purchasers of these devices, we are the beneficiaries of that competition.
Absolutely. As I said, I'm a Nikon user, but I don't want Sony or Canon to go away because just like you said, I want that competition.
I think I'm now sponsored by Panasonic, and I've been using the Micro Four Thirds cameras for quite a while, almost exclusively since this past winter. And I was just packing my camera bag for our trip, and I'm looking at the amount of gear that I have laid out. It's like I need a smaller bag now. I mean, this is a
wonderful. I got a bigger bag arriving tomorrow.
Oh, fun!
But yeah, I think that while I'm not going to jump out and buy these don't need. I don't think they can come out with what feels like a first generation. While it will be a first, I think it's a first generation full frame for Nikon. They've had other mirrorless.
Yeah, they had their one series, and that really didn't sell well outside of Japan.
But given where we are with the Sonys and everything, this can't feel like a first generation type thing.
Yeah, it has to feel like like it is a second or third generation, mm-hmm. that they've put everything that they can into it, and that shortly after it gets into the hands of the general public, you cannot have people complaining about firmware glitches, the camera randomly turning itself off, or randomly corrupting a memory card, or issues with autofocus that make it unusable in certain conditions if you're shooting straight into the sun, for example. Because no matter how obscure and unrealistic certain scenarios are, people are going to find every one of them and point fingers at them. Yep. That's just the society we live in.
If you're trying to get a D5 or a D850 user to move over and buy one of these, they're wanting that same autofocus performance when they move over. You don't want to feel like you've lost performance.
And it's an entirely different set of technologies, right? Mm-hmm. Because you don't have the same phase detect autofocus separate sensor. It's all based on the one sensor that has to do it all. Now, that's not to say that it can't be done. Just look what Sony did with the A9, as I mentioned. But still, you got to do it right.
And I think the added thing they're going to have is, I just mentioned the D5 and the D850 users and some other users too, that they're going to come over with their current glass, where if you move to Sony, you're as a Nikon user, move to Sony, you realize I'm gonna have to buy some new glass. But if you're moving over with my current glass, you know, my current 70-200 or whatever, I'm gonna have to use some kind of adapter.
And let's hope that everything communicates along the same protocols, so that that the lens does not suffer in the process.
I put that adapter on, put my 70-200 on. I still want excellent performance, like I'm getting on my D. I don't have a D5, but I have a D500, which gives excellent performance. I'm going to want that near that same performance.
Right. Well, we are on the cusp of this.
Yes, next week.
They are
right?
saying that August 23rd is the big unveiling. So keep me on the edge of my seat. And Nikon, you better impress with this, because if you don't, then you will have the money to make a round two. Mm-hmm. Will you have the money to make a round three if you don't get it done the second time either? This is a really tricky business, and there's a lot at stake here. So, cool. I will be watching with bated breath.
Me too.
Let's move on to a company that is, I guess you could call, in the process of failing. This is NetSE, which is the parent company for a lot of vintage lenses reborn into modern optical coatings and schnazzy brushed metal cases, and really a hipster market, although I can consider myself part of that in some degree. They own Meyer Optic, Oprema Jena, Emil Busch, CP Goers, IHG, and A. Schott, I assume. I'm pronouncing that correctly. These are a bunch of former German companies that are all now, I guess, the branding rights have been bought up by this one company, and they are producing products under those brands, oftentimes promoting them at low and semi-reasonable prices on Kickstarter as a crowdfunding campaign. But you know what? If you've followed any of these vintage lenses on crowdfunding campaigns, you'll notice that they often shoot way, way past their funding goal. Like, that funding goal is set arbitrarily low, so that once they hit it, then every sale is you know, in the bag. And I think that's because all of the research and development and the prototypes and the machining and the mass production scaling and everything is already sorted out beforehand, and they're just using this system as a method of pre-ordering. And hey, that works. Because you're building an audience, and that audience wants the product to exist, so you hit that crowdfunding goal. And but then the real incentive is the discount you get in the pre-order phase in the crowdfunding campaign, which can sometimes be substantial. You might be able to get some lenses for 50% of what the end retail price would be. And I'm going to make up some numbers here, but let's say you pay $800 US for a lens if you get some super early bird deal on it. Well, the retail price might be $1,600 for that same lens. And for me, okay, well, I might be on the fence about buying a $800 lens if it does me good. But double that price and I'm not going to touch it.
Right.
You know, there's going to be some other option, you know, especially if it's a vintage lens or a semi-vintage lens, a pseudo-vintage lens, because it is new. I mean, I can hit eBay or KEH or Kijiji or Amazon or any of these places where I might be able to find a used actual vintage original model of that lens for a fraction of what they're asking for the new hipster price to be. And so I think that might be part of the failings. And I'm, this is pure conjecture. I have no inside knowledge, but I'm seeing, and I am the owner of a Meyer Optic Trio Plan 100 that I paid $1,600 US for, which is foolishness. Man. I shouldn't have done that. Nope. You know, shame.
But if you enjoyed it, but have you enjoyed using it?
Oh yeah. And, okay. And my students love the bokeh effect, and I break it out and I let them try it. And I say, don't buy the new one. Look on eBay. You'll find one for half price. And yeah, if you have to pay $800 or $500 or whatever it is for a used one from the 1950s, do that instead, because there's no advantage, really. Yes, okay, you've got brand new shot glass with the latest optical coatings. It's an optically flawed lens to begin with. That's its allure. You don't – I mean, sure, yes, you want to – clean up the optics of a triplet design from 1916, be my guest. It's not going to have any impact on the overall quality.
So how's this company doing?
So they filed for bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at the details here. They have been removed from the German Stock Exchange, and they filed for insolvency. So the delisting occurred on July 2nd. And roughly 2 weeks later, on July 17th, the company has filed for bankruptcy. So this is, I don't know if it's a real concern for me. I love the fact that this company existed and was kind of revitalizing these lenses for every camera mount. And there is a market for that. The optically flawed lenses can be a lot of fun. In the previous episode, we discussed a guy that removed an internal series of lens elements and inverted the group and put it back together to create some crazy bokeh. That lens cost $70 on eBay. I bought one immediately before we even recorded the episode because I like to tinker and take stuff apart and put it back together with the obligatory, leftover screw. But or sometimes multiple. But in this case, if you were depending on the profitability of a particular product to exist beyond the initial push of a crowdfunding or pre-order campaign, and then you double the price afterwards, it kind of leaves a sour taste in people's mouth that didn't get in on the Kickstarter campaign, and they might just wait for the next one. Maybe they'll come out with that lens in a different focal length, and then they'll get in on that. Maybe they missed that too. Okay, well, I'm not even going to bother.
That is the challenge with discounting, coupons, any of that kind of stuff, is once people realize that, it's really hard to get them to pay full price.
Exactly. And so then once their initial campaign would be completed, then there's nothing left. It's maybe a trickle. You'll get a few, but you got to move on to the next project. And so sometimes they've had some issues where they wanted to bring back a classic camera brand with a new film SLR camera. I can't remember the exact brand that this was under, but they did not reach their funding goal for it. And that is a big issue, because if you've already put all of the money into research, development, tooling, a mass production roll-up, and you don't get your funding, you are so far in the hole at that point, and you're not going to be able to recoup it at all, because you can't just say, oh, well, you know what, by the way, we're still going to produce it, and you got to kind of hold to your guns. I got a sneaking suspicion that there was a few things happening behind the scenes that may have been big losses for them that has triggered this. But I don't think that overall that business model long term, as you continue to build up and add more staff and more overhead, I don't think it would have been.
Yeah, it was going to be a challenge. I like seeing companies try new things like this. We talked earlier about wanting competition in the camera market. So it's nice to see people try like this. But yeah, some of these business models just don't work long term.
Well, and you still have other people that are innovating. You've got Lens Baby. They've come out with some new gear recently. Their Soul lens, which we talked about again in one of the last episodes. And Lomography, they've got all sorts of weird and wonky things that you can pick up if you want to just muck with your light and come up with something artistic at the end of it. Or again, all of these lenses are based on classic designs that can be found on eBay from Soviet Russia or wherever else for almost nothing compared to what a modern lens would be. So again, that really, as awareness of their products grows, awareness of the cheaper versions probably also grows, which doesn't do them any favors either.
You know, this, I love hearing about new gear, like you just mentioned, that the new gear sometimes help you get out of a rut and get you back out there and get you excited again.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love tinkering. Like that lens, that $70 Ukraine lens that I have on order. It should arrive to me when I'm back from my travels. The first thing I'm going to do is, you know, find my jeweler screwdrivers and tear that thing apart. And I'm just going to have fun with it.
Yeah, that sounds exciting.
Yeah. But, you know, speaking of those travels and taking pictures, you know, I always fill up memory cards while I'm away. And that brings me to the next story. And this is interesting because this is a second stage kind of product here, or really fourth stage if you go all the way back, but at this capacity. Samsung, who has been making solid state drives for a long time, and I've owned some of their first ones, and they've been rock solid reliable for me, they are beginning to mass produce their high performance 4 terabyte QLC SSDs for consumers. And a 4 terabyte SSD, you think, okay, well, that just you know, has an air of unaffordability to it. Mm-hmm. And this is not their first 4 terabyte SSD. They had one in their Samsung Evo line, and that used TLC memory. And it's important to kind of discuss what these different memories are. There's basically four stages currently of SLC, MLC, TLC, QLC. So quad layer cell is what QLC stands for. Then, you know, triple MLC was multi, but it meant two, and then single. They're storing 4 bits of information for every memory cell that is on the device.
Okay.
And it's important to note that because, you know, for reliability standards, that makes it more suspect to potential failure. You lose one cell, you lose 4 bits and not one. But also reading and writing data ends up being slower the more bits that you are holding in a single cell of memory. So their previous version was a TLC, so 3 cells per bit. And adding another one will slow the drive down. You know, controllers increase in speed, it might not be as big of a degradation, but it is going to be a slower drive. That's why they say it's for consumers, because, you know, this is becoming more and more a storage device rather than a quick access device once you're hitting into the 4 terabyte plus market. Mm-hmm. So, do you own any SSDs, Mike?
So all of my PCs, except for the server, all the PCs I work on are SSD only.
Right.
So, you know, you say, well, how do you store all your photos? Well, I have a process where the current year is on an SSD by itself here. And then once I go past current year, I put it on the server, which is all, you know, spinning drives. So for mass storage, I have those on the server. But for current stuff and programs and cache and all that kind of stuff, it's all SSD.
Yeah, so my main computer is all SSD as well. I have a Synology NAS that has 12 bays. They're not all filled right now, but even as it is, I've got with a bunch of 8 terabyte drives plus some SSDs as a cache. I've got about 30 terabytes of usable space. 10 of that is still free, and when I get a little bit closer to zero, I'll throw in a couple of extra 8 terabyte hard drives, and away you go. But how often am I going to be throwing in hard drives at that point? Once I fill this up and a few years go by, it'll be 8 terabyte SSDs that I'll be popping out the hard drives and putting that in to replace them. And I think that that's going to come sooner rather than later, because this technology is just evolving so fast. Yeah. It was a year and a half or 2 years ago that I invested in an Intel, I think one of their 700 series PCI Express disk drives, SSDs, and it was lightning fast. 6 months later, the speed of the similar devices from other companies doubled. Yeah. I mean, it's just an unbelievable curve of speed and capacity that we're seeing here.
And what are the drives? Is it M.2, the ones that you actually, you know, connect to the motherboard via the PCI Express or something like that?
And U.2 is another format for that too. And these are much faster than the SATA bus, which it looks like, at least the version pictured here on the DP review, it looks like it's a SATA bus.
So I have I think it's M.2. That's what I have as my OS drive on my main machine.
Right. And, you look at this capacity, and even if it is slow, it's still going to be faster than the SATA bus can provide data to. So, you know, the bottleneck is not the QLC memory format here. Now, it's interesting, though, because this QLC format could be usable in a lot of other formats, because now you've got a much denser medium that you could throw 128 or 256 gigs of memory more affordably into smartphones. And I'm sure if somebody wanted to come out with, a 512 or a terabyte of data in a smartphone, I mean, these are low power 1 terabit VNAND chips that, it's just a cost thing. It's not a is it possible kind of thing. It just will drive up the cost of the device and possibly hurt battery life. And everybody complains about that. But imagine having like a terabyte of data in your smartphone. I mean, this is the world that we're going to be living in the next 2 to 5 years so easily, so quickly. It's just going to be a blink before we're there.
The cost on these have come way down. You know, now it used to be that only the enthusiasts had SSDs in their computers a few years back. Now almost everybody does. And like in my case, it's all my drives that are in there because it became so affordable and the sizes have gotten bigger. And you're talking about 4 terabytes here. You know, you talk about 8 terabytes of spindles in your server. I'm putting 10 terabytes in my server, but that gap between the edge of the consumer spindle and the edge of the consumer SSD is closing.
Yeah, and you can buy 14 terabyte physical spinning disk hard drives right now. It will cost you a lot.
Yes. I'm talking consumer reasonably cost.
Exactly, and now, but what you're saying is that these gaps are getting smaller and smaller. Now, I remember seeing the price of the 4 terabyte Evo drives. They were, I think, $1,700 or so.
So it's still pretty expensive.
Still pretty expensive. And so my guess is, because there's no release dates or prices for these new drives, $1,200. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to shave off a good portion of the price and sacrifice performance as a result. And I think that's a fair trade-off to push it into the consumer market. $1,200 is still a lot. There will be lower capacity versions as well. You don't have to go for the full 4 terabytes. They've got a 1 and a 2 terabyte version coming too.
Yeah, mass storage for us home users is still better to go with spindles. And then, you know, for your programs and your OS drive and things like that, that's where you go with a terabyte or something in that range. That is a reasonably priced SSD. If you can afford to spend the $1,200 or $1,500 or $1,700 for one of these, more to you. But that's I wouldn't go that expensive in a drive.
I already did. I mean, that's about what I paid for my my Intel like super fast drive. Yeah. Now, the motherboard that I'm using just in its final sort of end of life firmware update added support for those NVMe drives, and so I figured I'll buy one then, and then I don't have to upgrade the storage because I'm not going to take advantage of anything more than that. And let's just buy it now. Well, these ones are still available, and I should have waited a few months. But that is technology.
It is technology. You wait a few months and something new's out and everything's cheaper. But you know, it'll never stop. So at some
it'll
point,
never stop.
At some point, we don't want it to. At some point, you've got to just bite the bullet and buy it.
Speaking of my greater than $1,000 investments in a single technological component.
So wait, we had the lens. We have the SSD. What are you about to talk about now?
Okay, so Red Cameras has announced, and we've talked about this before, their Hydrogen 1 smartphone. And so this is a device that has a no glasses required 3D. They say holographic, which I take to mean, having not seen the device, if you view it from slightly different angles, you get a slightly different perspective of the subject. So it's not just a stereoscopic view, it can be viewed from different angles to see it differently. It comes equipped with stereoscopic 3D cameras, and it is a beast. It is slightly bigger than the iPhone X, and every bit of ingenuity that Red Cameras is known for is going into this device. Well, they've had some issues because They don't know what the hell they're doing. And I say that delightfully because they've never made a smartphone before. And they are trying to make a flagship device, having never made one before in their history. The main guy behind this, Jim Jannard, who originally started Oakley Sunglasses, he was told by the industry, you can't start a sunglass company. I mean, this is an established market. You're not going to make any waves. Okay. Then he decided to start Red, and Red came out of nowhere, and they are now one of the biggest players in the cinema space. But the established old guard said, what the heck are you doing? You can't do that. You will never succeed. And so now they are about to enter the smartphone market with the Red Hydrogen, and the same naysayers, well, different naysayers, different industry, but the same kind of people are talking about it. And they've had some issues. They had some issues with certification. Some parts needed to be retooled. We don't know what. It could be because of radiation leakage, or you know, it didn't pass the FCC muster, whatever was required. They've been going back and retooling things and resetting up for production. But to those people that pre-ordered, which I did, they had two versions, one aluminum and one titanium. I figured, well, why not go for the titanium? Yeah. I had to compromise because they are making developer units. They're calling it the Houdini unit. And this is it's not a prototype. It is kind of finalized hardware, but the firmware is going to be rapidly updated constantly. So is the software. I'm getting into a developer cycle here at that point, and they're only making them in aluminum. So I've had to make that sacrifice. But I'll be getting it the same week that I get back from my travels.
Oh, really?
So normally the backers would be getting them in October, and then the carrier release would be at some point after that. And there are two carriers that are very eager to jump on board for this. But I've been a fan of 3D for a couple of years, and this is I am certain that this is going to be one of those paradigm shifts. As soon as you see one of these phones, you will want one of these phones displaying 3D content. And once that becomes a pervasive, then Leia, the company that makes the display that Red owns a part of, I believe, I'm sure they'll freely license that tech to Samsung and Apple and everybody else in the marketplace. And then Red's going to, you know, hit the top of the game once again. So I know you probably haven't been following this as closely as I have. The link that's going to be in the show notes, Mike, is a forum that the founder of Hydrogen and of Red is posting on regularly, but this doesn't make the main news feeds. I read this forum to figure out what these updates are and when I'm going to get this new wonderful piece of dream technology, of which, you know, with the turnabout that Red has in their product revisions and product cycle, phone donuts good enough for me. Whenever they come out with the Hydrogen 2, or maybe they'll call it the Helium, I have no idea. I'll pre-order that too. I'm a sucker for this kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, they're a credible company. I mean, look what they've done with the Red camera. So I'm not expecting, you know, junk. And if they Gen 1 doesn't get there, they're going to keep at it. I am excited. I'm not going to be able to experience it because I think you said once you see it, you have to really see it in person, right? You're not going to hold it up to your webcam and me experience it.
No. You have to have two eyes involved in the right. process with, like, on that screen directly.
Right.
You know, it has to kind of grow through a in-person, traditional word-of-mouth kind of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, you said it's been delayed, but you should have it when you come back from your trip?
They're going to be shipping it around September 6th, I think. So okay. I'll have it in my hands, and I've been shooting 3D content for a little while. I'll convert that to their 4V format, and from there, I'll be showing it to people. And when I was doing the art show recently that I talked about at the top of the show, I brought an antique stereoscope. I have it sitting beside me right here. That thing is from 1867.
Wow.
It's 151 years old. It's a bait stereoscope. And I love the thing. It's got really good lenses in it. And I make my own stereo cards for that more as a hobby than as anything professional. But they're really nice stereo cards. And so I brought some to sell. And I sold about a dozen of them. Some of them to people that don't have a stereoscope and never saw one before. I had people looking through this device. And some people were swearing. They were ushering obscenities when they looked through the viewfinder as a compliment to what they were seeing.
Yeah, well, I can envision what they were saying.
So if you could imagine somebody seeing something for the first time and swearing with delight, I think that's the same experience that people are going to have.
So wait, they bought it, but they have no way to look at it when they get back home?
You can get antique stereoscopes on eBay for like 30 or 40 bucks. It's not a difficult thing to get. Even there's something called the Owl Viewer. And that was created by Dr. Brian May, who some people might know of as a guitarist, as the lead guitarist for Queen. Others may know him as because of his PhD in astrophysics. Others may still know him because of his love of 3D photography. And so he made a little plastic 3D viewer that folds up really nicely, and you can still get those through a number of venues. I bought mine on eBay, but you might be able to get it through more official channels. And the little cards will fit right in that thing as well. So if you like Queen, then you can go and get one of Brian May's stereo viewers too. It's an age-old thing. And I know why 3D TVs and everything didn't take off. It was twofold. Number one, I don't want to have to wear glasses when I watch TV. I mean, I don't normally wear glasses. Mike, I see you wearing glasses. Maybe it's not as big of a stretch for you.
No, but I don't want to have to wear other glasses on top of these glasses.
Yeah, well, and that adds up. And then there's eye strain involved in that too. And the number of 3D movies put out that were just bad, gimmicky, garbage stuff that people were subjected to. I mean, we needed more avatars during that initial push
of 3D.
You mean
like Friday the 13th or Jason in 3D?
Yeah, lovely. Or any A-list movie they made a 3D version of. Some of them they didn't even shoot in 3D, and they converted to 3D, and they did that on a budget, and that just doesn't work. So we need more good content, and so let's hope that it comes. And I've got a good suspicion that it will, because Red is also going to be producing some high-end cinema 3D cameras. So you will be able to get stereoscopic or more potentially, because they're 4V format. If you only have two eyes and you're looking at the screen, viewing it from different angles won't yield a significant difference in your perspective. But if you had four cameras, then that holographic viewing it from slightly different angles will become a much, much more interesting effect. And if a screen size was slightly larger, for example, and you could walk by a screen like a TV and see it holographically from different angles because it was shot from multiple cameras, then it's coming. I mean, this is the tip of the iceberg. And anybody that's it's like, Don, just stop talking about this stupid thing. When you see one, you will understand why I am so excited.
It's an exciting time to be alive.
It is. So I won't drone on too much more about that. Let's get into.
We'll wait for you to get it when you come back and hear, all the what your thoughts on it. Yeah.
You know what? When I was a young child, we had a German Shepherd Husky mix, beautiful dog. Whenever we would come back from a trip abroad, like even if we were gone for like a day, he would get so excited that he would pee himself. We'd have to make sure that he was outside we made first contact. That might be me in this scenario.
Are you going to need an adult diaper?
You know what? Maybe I'll have to be sitting somewhere appropriate.
Yes.
or the unboxing.
If that happens, you don't need to share that level of detail.
Well, exactly. I'll keep that to myself. We were talking about Kickstarter campaigns earlier, or crowdfunding in general. It doesn't have to be through that platform. But we're into the picks of the week now. And I think the pick that you have, Mike, is from one of those said campaigns.
Yep. I think the campaign may be over, still up there, but I bought it from the website. It's from Covered Camera, K-U-V-R-D. I think that's a neat way for them to say Covered, KUVRD camera.com. And they call it a universal lens cap. It comes in, you're not going to be able to see it, but it comes in a plastic jar. and it is a rubberized lens cap. And it's they call it universal because it's supposed to fit on any lens. They say any lens, but I don't think they really mean like a 400-28.
Or something that has like a 36 millimeter filter thread.
Yeah, something really tiny. So, I mean, I put it on my 50 millimeter. I put it on my 85, 1.8 lens on both of those. I put it on the 7200. So I will tell you that I think the design that they're talking about here was supposed to provide more protection to your lens cap, give it a better grip on there so it wouldn't fall off in the bag. If you put it on the back and the front of the lens on a smaller lens and they overlap, it even could provide some water and dust, sand protection, all that kind of stuff. If you watch their video, that you show them tossing it into a river, tossing it into sand and rubbing around in the sand and even dropping it on the ground. Now, I don't know how much this tiny little bit of rubber is going to protect it.
Yeah, you might be overselling it there.
But it wasn't that. For a lens cap, for this little lens cap, you might say, wow, you overpaid for it. But in the grand scheme of things, it was like $25, so it wasn't that bad. I wanted to buy it, see firsthand what it was like. And I would say on my Nikon 85mm 1.8 lens, it really is a good fit, and it's easy to put on, easy to take off. It does generally take two hands to put on.
Oh, so that's a challenge.
Yeah, so if you think about your lens caps, at least in my situation, I can always take them off with one hand, put them on with one hand. You can't take this off with one hand, but putting it on is going to be two hands. And then I tried it on my 7200, which I think is a 77 millimeter front. And that was a little difficult to put it on there. So that was two hands stretching it, and still I had to be careful I didn't knock over the lens doing it. Then, but I don't know about you, but with my 7200, the way I carry my lens, the way I put it in my bag, which is when I'm going to have the lens cap on, is with the lens hood in storage mode. And yep. In that mode, getting this thing on is nearly impossible. So this is my pick of the week to check it out and see if it is for you, but it's not for me. It's not something I'm going to buy.
Well, I love that this is on our radar, and I for $25, and again, it might be more expensive now that a campaign is over, and you might have to pay retail price for it. But that is the cost of experimentation for me. That is part of my research and development budget, just to see what's going to work, and maybe something like that could be very useful. Especially if I need a very robust lens cap that I can whip off very, very quickly, and I don't have to worry about putting it on really quickly because the moment has passed and now I've got some time to collect my thoughts as I collect my gear. But I remember speaking with a Canadian photojournalist, the late Boris Spremo. And we had some great phone conversations. I attended one of his presentations in person. Very, very powerful speaker and outstanding images. But at one point he said, and I'll paraphrase, but he said, "Don, I know you're like me. Your camera gear, you just throw it in the back seat of your car. There's no front cap. There's no rear cap. It's just there. You put it together. You get a good shot. If there's a dust spot on an award-winning photograph, then you have an award-winning photograph that happens to have a dust spot. I mean, it's not going to make and break the end result of what you're trying to create. And for me, I find that to be ultimately valuable advice. I had people in my studio recently for workshops, and they said, "Don, I don't see any caps on the front or back of your lenses." And I'm like, "Yeah, that sounds about right. They're not going to break. So they might collect a bit of dust, but that dust won't show up in any of my images. Yeah, maybe it'll make its way, through a flapping mirror on my old Canon SLRs onto the sensor at some point. But you know what? I can clean that. It takes me 5 minutes to clean a sensor, maybe less than that. And so it's not a huge concern of mine when my priorities are to go on to the next project and use my time valuably. Again, lens caps in general are kind of not my thing.
Well, I do keep lens caps on mine. And for me, I don't have an issue with them. They don't fall off a lot. They're not hard to put on or take off. But so I just bought this to see what it was like. It does look pretty cool when I put it on the 85 millimeter.
And it's a soft rubber, right?
It is a soft rubber.
So if you had a few of those on lenses side by side, they wouldn't rub up against each other as heavily. And so in the bag that I'm taking for traveling, it's just a messenger bag that I will try to divide things up a little bit, but things are kind of jumbled around. I don't want it to look like it's a camera bag.
Yeah.
I've got some microfiber cloths that I might wrap some stuff in. But if I had a bunch of those, that would do that same duty.
So can I have a more than one pick of the week?
Sure, go for it.
Okay, you talked about bags. So I just got back from a trip to Alaska, and bags are one of those things that what I like, you may not like. And to me, it's almost like there is no perfect bag, right?
And I think exactly.
Lots of people are in search of the perfect bag, and you never get it. So what I'm about to talk about, you may not be your favorite bag, whatever, but I bought this bag for my trip. I wanted to make sure that it was something I could put in the overhead on any camera I was going to go on, because I don't want to check my gear. And so it is going to be somewhat limited, and I can't take my biggest glass. But I didn't want to haul that all around anyway for the trip I was doing. So I got the Think Tank Airport Essentials bag. And that bag fits my 7200, fits a full body, digital SLR. I did have to take the grip off and store it separately, and several other lenses. Great pockets, great system, great, felt comfortable in the back and all that stuff. I loved it so much that I got its big brother coming tomorrow. This is why I mentioned this. I got its big brother coming tomorrow, the AirPort Accelerator, which still is supposed to fit in most airplane overheads, but I bought it more for local. I can put my two biggest lenses in there, two bodies, and some other stuff, and go out to shoot sports and have all my gear with me that I need for that. So for me, I'm liking the Think Tank brand. There are some things that I might want to change, but of all the bags I've bought for me, those are my favorites.
All right. I've got a whole slew of bags myself. And, we do a whole podcast on just that.
Yes.
I mean, it's like, women love shoes. Photographers love bags.
Yes.
I mean, it is the closest thing we have to a fashion accessory. And all of those pockets in just the right places. And yeah, we can geek out over that too.
Absolutely.
Thanks for that. I want to have, if you can send me a link to both of those,
okay.
And we'll put them in the show notes.
Yep.
That way I can get a good look at this bag and see if it is the object of my desire as well. You can often tell just by looking at them if it's something that you want to be carrying around.
Right. Some people want a shoulder bag. Some people want a backpack. So there's no perfect bag.
There isn't. If there was, there's no perfect art. There's no perfect song. There's no perfect painting. all right. I was mentioning the $25 cost being something worthy of a research and development kind of budget. Well, mine comes in under that at $15. Mm. And if you want to dip your toes in the water, I know I was opining on about 3D photography, you can get yourself a VR headset, effectively, for $15. And it is the Google Cardboard. And your phone slides in. And it has two, they're like plastic lenses, but they are pretty good for what they are. And there's a little button on the top that you can press, and that actually connects down to something that presses, if I could open this up, it presses to something right in the middle there, and that will act as a point of contact on the phone itself, so that you can have a button outside of the case that actually interacts, and so you can, this is useful for games, and there's 3D content apps and what have you. And if anybody goes out and goes to buy a Google Cardboard, and you email me, I will personally email you a series of images that I have shot in 3D. You can view them on your phone, and you can say, wow. So for $15, anybody listening, go to photogeekweekly.com. The Picks of the Week section will show you the links, or you can just type Get Google Cardboard into Google, and you'll find the place. The Google one is $15, but there's a lot of other companies that make these. The highest price they go is around $30. Even Mattel has come out with one that is a ViewMaster VR. For about $30. And
Cardboard,
if you're
also
really nostalgic about ViewMaster, you can get one that looks just like one.
Yeah, and that one's cardboard also?
No, the ViewMaster one is made of plastic.
Okay.
But it's the cardboard standard. Okay. And so you check out their website, and there's some like steampunk designs and all sorts of other crazy stuff that are very cool. Interesting and kind of fun. So yeah. Google Cardboard, putting that on everybody's radar. And we're nearing the end of this episode. Mike, it's been great to have you here.
Great to come back.
And, you know, as you're getting back into potential guests on the JPEG to RAW podcast, I really hope that I'm going to be an upcoming guest when I'm back from my travels. So you might be able to listen to me there. Where is there? Is that jpegtoraw.com?
Yep, that's it. That's the way to, where you can find us.
Perfect. And I'm sure that you post new episodes to social media in a variety of places as well.
Out on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. And, of course, you can find the podcast itself on iTunes and all kind of other places. Yes.
And it's all linked to at jpegtoraw.com. Yep. So, perfect. Check Mike out there. And, for me, doncom.ca, donkom.ca. I'll be posting new workshops when I'm back from travels, including if anybody is interested in tagging along with me to Iceland in October of 2019. That's going to be a fun little adventure that I'm working on some documentation to put out there with the itinerary and everything. If people have enjoyed my macro photography and want to shoot macro, I've got a course that I just released through On One, who's one of my sponsors. And so that is onone.com/doncom.